once more under the breach, dear friend.
Else close the wall up with our English dead.
And here we are, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, with another exciting second hour of The Personal Wealth Coach, starring Jeff and
Jake
McClure on this February 9th, 2019. And if it is February 9th, 2019, where you are, you're welcome to give us a call at 254-773-1400. And you know what? I didn't do the disclosure first hour.
So Let's do that.
The Personal Wealth Coach is the name not only of this radio program, but also of an SEC-registered investment advisor headquartered in Salado. And the information we present on here is not investment advice. It's educational information. Investment advice is given to you individually by an investment advisor. Preferably, you will get the registered kind, not the unregistered kind. And the investment advisor then gives you advice based on your individual circumstances and what's appropriate for you. Education is a completely different thing and enables you to make some good decisions, hopefully, but it is not advice. The information that we do give on here educationally has been obtained from sources we believe to be reliable and consistent and dependable, things like the Wall Street Journal, Financial Times, The Economist, and the United States government, among other things, and the Federal Reserve. But we don't make any guarantees or warranty as to the accuracy, because in many cases we get it out of those journals and so on, and they do come back and make corrections, but we generally get it right. When we don't, we'll be glad to tell you about it.
All right. I've got some things on the tax subject that I can throw out here. Taxes are different this year than they've been for a long time, and they were there last year too, but people were just getting used to them. There's a distribution method. If you're above the age of 70 and a half and you have an IRA and you want to give to charity, there's something you got to approach this with your tax advisor and hopefully with a fiduciary and make sure that the charity that you're giving to is a good one. But it's something called a qualified charitable distribution. If you're above the age of 70 and a half, the government starts requiring you to take out distributions from your IRA. They're called required minimum distributions. A lot of times they'll be referred to as RMDs. If you want to give your RMD or a portion of your RMD to a charity without having paid taxes on it to begin with, there's something called a qualified charitable distribution. If you're planning on taking advantage of that, you need to talk to the people who you've tasked with getting the money to you now, not wait till the end of the year. Because if you wait till the end of the year, your required minimum distribution's probably already been given to you. If it's already been given to you, it's too late. You can't do the qualified charitable distribution on the required minimum. You just have to do it on the extra stuff above it. If you do want to take the money that you've already received for the year and give it to charity, you still get a deduction for it.
Maybe.
But you get it only if you are itemizing. And most people aren't itemizing anymore because of the new tax law.
If you use the method of distributing directly from your IRA using your required minimum distribution and you make it into a required contribution, not required, but a contribution directly, you don't get taxed on it.
Right. You got to do it appropriately. There's the right forms to do and it's got to be filed correctly on your taxes and all that good stuff. But if you don't start thinking about it now, most people start thinking about this in December, which is when most charitable contributions take place. That's usually too late for this. So think about this first. Let's see, what's another one? You're not required to put your Roth IRA contribution in your tax return. Why? Because you pay taxes on it. You don't get a deduction for doing it. Do it anyway. This is something that we hear from the CPAs kind of across the board. If you're doing a Roth IRA contribution, stick it in your tax return. For one thing, it will remind...
But not in your ear.
Not in your ear. Don't stick it in your ear or any other orifice for that matter. Stick it in your tax return. All it does is it shows the IRS that the Roth exists, that the money is in there. If they ever come back and want proof that you have been, that money was all treated with, they've already taxed it, paid on it, and all that stuff, it's better to have it in the system. It's also good because it lets you know how long the Roth has existed in general. There's a five-year limitation before you can take the principal out without a 10% penalty, assuming you're below the age of 59 and a half. Man, this is complicated stuff.
But, yeah, it's called the U.S. tax code.
Right, but if you're keeping track of it there, then it's something you can point to the IRS if they say, hey, you pulled money out of your Roth IRA and it hasn't been 5 years. You can at least point at your tax returns that they already have on hand rather than having to dig up all of the statements and so on to send them for when the actual Roth was the one that the withdrawal came from. Was there. It's also important so that you can prove to the IRS that you made the contribution in a year that you were qualified to do it. Roth IRAs, if you make too much money, you can't make the contribution. So all of that stuff is important. It's not important this year. It's important sometime in the next years if you ever get audited. So that's just important information. Another thing is that if you're listening and you're young and you're not at the peak of your income yet, if you're at the beginning of your career and you're making your Roth IRA contributions, if you haven't put this information into your tax return, you're not going to know if you get a tax credit for it. The Retirement Savers Tax Credit is an important piece of information there. It's money back to you, and it could be 50% if you're in the lowest income that's qualified, 50% of the money that you put in there could come back to you as a check. So that's like the government matching you on a 401k that's not a 401k, it's a Roth. You put a dollar in there, they give you 50 cents. That's pretty cool. The only way you're going to get that is if you put it in the tax return, and most people do not. Those are the big ones to talk about. Most of the rest of the taxes, if you're not itemizing your deductions and so on, if you don't have more than $24,000 of deductions, then the rest of the stuff isn't that important.
Is
if you're a small business,
married? That's married, right?
That's married. So it's $12,000
right
per. And the big deal here is remembering one. What you've done, and if you're a small business owner, this is probably the last piece on the tax subject that I have lined up. But it may be absolutely the most important. If you're a small business owner, you need to hire a CPA if you don't already have one, because the taxes, when they got changed, are far more complicated than they were before.
Complicated. The simplification from this tax act that we got last year, just on section, what's now called section 199, which is the pass-through 20% deduction, 450-some pages long. And that's not counting footnotes and everything else. I mean, it was over 400 pages of very complex rules that a CPA probably will understand, and if you're doing your own taxes, you probably won't. And the potential for messing that one up on a scale of 1 to 10 is about 12.
Yeah. The taxes are we're still going back to statements that we've made over the last decade. If we don't get the tax code simplified in some way in the near future,
we'll have a lot of more CPAs.
Yeah, we're going to have a lot more CPAs, and we'll have a lot more money spent on just doing taxes rather than paying taxes. When doing taxes costs a significant portion of your tax bill, then the complication is too high, and if you're a small business owner, that is likely to be the case. You are likely to spend, if you grossed in the vicinity of $200,000, you're likely to spend somewhere in the vicinity of $3,000 to $5,000 on getting your taxes done. That is, I'm going to use a non-politically correct term, that's stupid. If that's an expense for doing taxes, it should be going to the government and paying off the debt, not trying to figure out how much we owe.
Speaking of taxes, I've read some articles supporting Elizabeth Warren's wealth tax that starts at $50 million.
Right.
And you say, sure, well, there's this tendency among the general population to say, okay, that's the 0.1%. If you're $50 million net worth and above is 0.1% of America, so let's soak the rich. Let's hit them with a 1% or a 2% tax. Here's the problem with that, and I've been thinking a lot about it, and it's the reason that a lot of nations, that a lot of European nations used to have a wealth tax, and they got rid of it. And now in Florida, they still do, in a sense. They have an intangible assets tax. But the thing about intangible assets, these are things like stocks and bonds and insurance and things and annuities and things like that, where you have something that's not solid, it's sitting there on the ground, and you can't touch it, it's intangible. They are priced. You can tell exactly what they're worth on any given day because you get a statement. The problem with the wealth tax, think about some family that owns a big ranch in West Texas. The highest and best use value of that ranch is to break it up into tiny ranchettes, spend a few million dollars on it and put roads in and things like that, and then sell it off in pieces. So that's one value. Another value
and
is...
And here's the problem with that particular value is that you have to do it, and it's going to take years to get it done.
Right.
And then the demand might not be... I mean, there have been a lot of people in West Texas that have set up little tiny ranchettes and then gone bankrupt because nobody buys them.
The problem with that, of course, is A, you have to spend a lot of money to make it up to its highest and best use. And secondly, as Jake said, it might not work out, so the highest and best use might produce a zero valuation after taxes. The difficulty is there's lots of ways of saying what that ranch is worth, and the government coming in and arbitrarily, some bureaucrat saying, guess what, your ranch is worth $50 million because you've got all this desert land that could be divided up into ranchettes.
And that's the death of a 12-generation ranch because
right.
It now has to be split up and sold so that they can pay the taxes on it.
And the point is, and I've actually seen this happen with estate taxes, when they go to sell the ranch, because in the old estate tax regime where we had relatively low exclusions, they go to sell the ranch and they actually get less money for the entire ranch than the tax bill.
Right. The valuation was so preposterous by the IRS that the entire ranch is worth less than the taxes due on this phantom valuation.
And, you know, if somebody wants to come along and say at $50 million intangible value, that's stocks and things of that nature, we decide as a nation it's a good idea to tax that. That's the equivalent of a property tax, only not on property.
Right.
You know, and the other thing is the ranch, the lot your house is on, those are wealth, and they are already taxed. We call that property tax, and that's
right.
Okay. And you're going to pay the property tax. But to have the federal government come along and put a property tax effectively on everything you own every year so that you have to have an evaluation on it.
And there's another piece of that as well.
Let me finish one thing
here.
The income tax started on the upper 1% of Americans.
And
don't think
spread down to everybody else.
Don't think that if somebody passes a tax that says you're a wealth tax and it's only if you have $50 million, don't think it'll stay there. That will creep back down to where every year you have to have an appraisal on your house to figure out how much tax you have to pay.
Right.
And that's not going to be any fun. Locally, I think we have a pretty good system where the local appraiser, who has to, by the way, get elected, comes along and says, here's what your house is worth. And you may argue with them, but generally speaking, they've got a system for resolving it face-to-face. At the federal government level, that is a scary monster.
All right, and there's another thing. Quite often, Jeff Bezos, who's been in the news a lot this week, is considered the wealthiest man on the planet.
Yay.
He's considered that because his net worth is associated with the value of Amazon.com, the value of the Washington Post. He owns 16% of Amazon. He's going through a divorce. He may not come through this owning 16%.
He may wind up with 8%.
But, yeah, and she was a big part of the founding of the company,
yeah.
So that's important. But in the middle of that, if we're applying this wealth tax on something, it goes back to something. How do you know how much he's worth? Because if you took 16% of Amazon and sold it right now, it would cause the price of Amazon to drop to near nothing because there's not people out there that are willing to buy up 16% of Amazon. There's not enough people interested in it. it would cause a sale, just like we were talking about with the ranch. If you break it apart and sell it, there's not enough interest there. If you sold a small part of it and then and you got some money, this is the Jeff Bezos concept. If he sells a couple of $1 billion worth of Amazon, there's demand for that. And he's turned around in the last year and taken a $2 billion and devoted it to charity. And that was from his sale of Amazon. Now, I'm not saying he's poor. Don't get me wrong there. He's very wealthy.
Poor Jeff.
But he doesn't have the kind of cash on hand to pay that kind of a tax on a regular basis without selling huge amounts of his Amazon. And what does that mean for the management of the company that he owns,
and
if he no longer owns the company?
And it also is good to remember that if you have property, if a wealthy person has property that's actually producing income for them, making them more wealthy, or appreciating in value and they intend to sell it in the future, they're going to pay taxes when they sell it.
Yeah, absolutely.
And they're going to pay taxes on the income. So if you want to mess around with taxes on actual cash resulting from the sale of a property, or actual cash resulting from the actual cash that is income from the property, and you want to tax that makes sense. But having at the same time lowered tax rates for upper income people and then turn around and try to hit them with a tax on their wealth. Let me tell you, Elizabeth Warren, or as the president likes to call her, and I hate to say this,
don't do it.
The person who just on Fox News was being mentioned for apologizing for claiming to be a Cherokee.
Though she has some Cherokee blood, she claimed to be a Cherokee, and that's not the same thing.
Right, and the point is that I really think that's a poor idea, and a lot of European nations that used to have it got rid of it.
Yeah, the whole concept of the income tax, as much as I dislike its complexity, it doesn't distort ownership. Ownership is what defines our middle class. The fact is that the majority of Americans own parts of the business of America. If you own any stock, any bonds, any mutual funds, you own a chunk of something in America. And that is not normal in the rest of the world. If we turn and start taxing that, it will make it more expensive to own things. That is our claim to fame. This is the American dream. This is how we are more innovative than the rest of the world. We get to own what we make. If you think about your home and you say, hey, I'm about to have my mortgage paid off, it's mine free and clear, you still owe taxes on that for the rest of your life, even if it's capped out because you're a senior citizen. You still owe taxes on that property, and unless we have some method of replacing that revenue to the local governments, that's not going to go away. But it means that if you worked your entire life to own something so that it would be an inexpensive thing in your retirement, and we have any kind of property tax, it just decays that. It is the issue that makes it hard to pass wealth on to children, is if you've got friction at every point from taxes, it makes it harder to own things. We're moved more toward a socialist system than toward a capital system. Now, we've got problems on the capitalist side, don't get me wrong there, but to add more problems doesn't fix the other problems. Yes,
there's two signaling warnings that I want to sound out here in the big wide world. Whether it's because the SEC has gotten more efficient, which I don't think, or because it's actually because people, when Ponzi schemes start to run out of money, they file a complaint.
Right.
But it seems like it used to be once a month or so there was an announcement of a relatively major Ponzi scheme that went off someplace. And
now
it seems like they're coming weekly.
Three or
maybe
four a week,
sometimes
actually.
Sometimes 3 or 4 a week. There's one recently in Texas.
Big one.
Which had run for 13 years. And during that 13-year period, this organization threw, and this is really interesting because they just hammered a broker-dealer for inadvertently allowing this to happen, sometimes through regular stockbrokers or financial advisors, was selling. What they were doing was illegal. It was selling away. But they were selling interests in this Woodbridge Capital fund that was supposedly used to purchase real estate and develop it. And for 13 years, people were getting payments monthly at the rate of 10% a year. If and you think about something, if you just met somebody for the last 12 years, has got a steady income equating to 10% a year on an investment they made a decade ago, and they said, you should get in this too, man, would you ever want to get into that thing? Obviously, because it sounds like such a good deal, except for the fact until this last year when Woodbridge suddenly stopped working. They suddenly stopped functioning. They were producing false statements. They were producing false income as a Ponzi scheme. The later investors were money was being used to pay off early investors. And all the people who had their many millions of dollars, many of these cases were retirement, older people who'd taken their retirement funds and put it into this thing. Among them, by the way, were a group, different groups of people who did what's called affiliation investing. There was a member of their church that they trusted, who, incidentally, the member of their church they trusted in many cases was as suckered in as they were, who sold it to them. They trusted the person who sold it to them because the person was trustworthy and the person believed in what they were selling, but they didn't realize that this was an unregistered fund, and that's the key right there. It was an unregistered fund. It was an unregistered pool of money. It wasn't registered under the Investment Company Act of 1940, and that's one you should etch in your brain. If it's not registered under the Investment Company Act of 1940 and you can't go to the SEC and see that it's registered, and you should just completely stay away from that thing because it is not registered, it is not regulated. And these people, I mean, Woodbridge does not have any money to pay these people back. They're not going to get money back. Now, some of them are going to have a very unpleasant experience, just like they did with Madoff, because the bankruptcy trustee is going to go in and claw back money from the people who've been getting money for 13 years.
That's not pleasant, because these are not people that had any knowledge that they were doing anything wrong. They thought they were getting a good income off of their investment, and they went and bought cars with it, or they bought their dream house with it. And when the investigators say, hey, that was stolen goods, you owe us it back. Well,
let's
say you got to figure out where to get the money.
Let's say you gave him you gave Woodbridge $500,000 years and years ago. And over a 10-year period of 10% a year, they've paid you back $500,000. And you think, okay, well, I've lost $500,000, but I got $500,000 of interest. I'm break-even. And then the bankruptcy trustee comes back and says, no, you owe us $500,000, because that $500,000 you got
was from somebody else's pocket.
Was not. You are an unsecured creditor like everybody else, and you can, when you line up, you'll get your percentage. But meanwhile, you owe the federal government, effectively, $500,000. And they're not a really good group of people to owe money to.
Yeah, when they show up knocking on the door, that's not a good thing.
So there are going to be a lot of people around the state, not only who've lost their retirement around the country, because some of these, there's another one was based here in Texas, but who not only lost their retirement money that they put in and their income suddenly stops, but suddenly realize that they're going to lose their house and who knows what else. They're going to have to declare bankruptcy because they invested in an unregistered fund that turned out to be a Ponzi scheme.
This is something, this is a new update. You'll appreciate this. During the time of Madoff, Ponzi schemes, I don't know how they do this. It's kind of like Chinese restaurants. There's studies on this, that the Chinese restaurants across the country have menus that are very similar to each other, but there's no corporate office that's setting that menu. It's just demand that sets the menu. People come in and they say, I want beef broccoli, and so beef broccoli is going to have to be on the menu, or I want chicken lo mein. They have to have that.
Mugu gaipan.
Right, and when a lot of these aren't actually even Chinese foods. They're just now recognized in America as Chinese foods, so the menu has to be there. Ponzi schemes are operating the same way. In the time of Madoff, the guarantees that they were offering kind of unilaterally across the board was 12%.
Right, 1% a month.
Now, that 12%, you look at the market returns over a long period of time, it seems relatively reasonable. The number that's being offered now is 9 or 9.5%. If they offer 12%, that seems a little too good. So if you're being offered a 9% guarantee on any type of investment, this is like reading the Chinese menu. you got to have your first red flag pop up and say, hey, this is at the moment the textbook Ponzi scheme, 9%. That's where you should say, and most people just, they don't look past that 9%. They get a little bit greedy and they say, hey, I can, this isn't bad.
I just got an advertisement this week on the internet for a fixed annuity at 8.5%, guaranteed 8.5%.
Yeah, that's dangerous.
Which says, and I looked at that, and it's probably legitimate because of the way they figure it. And if you read the fine print and all the fine print of the fine print,
you'll probably
realize
find out you're
really it's not 8.5%.
Much more like 3% or no real guarantee, just a guarantee on your income number that they are adding to.
Just recognize that anytime somebody comes and offers you a deal that has, it says guaranteed and a high interest rate relative to what you can get someplace else, there's a danger. Now I got another one for you.
All right.
Fitch issued a warning about bond funds, corporate bond funds, in any form or fashion. Now, they specifically were honed in on ETFs regarding regarding high-yield bond funds, but high-yield bond funds in general, but corporate bond funds in general. And the reason is, if interest rates rise, which at some point I kind of think they're going to, I've been waiting for them, but they've actually risen some over the last year, Fitch looked at the liquidity, the number of bond dealers that are out there who actually, if a bond fund says, and I'm not talking about short-term bond funds, I'm talking about longer-term bond funds with higher interest rates. People have been gravitating to high interest rate bond funds, and some of them are investment grade and some of them aren't. But the point is, those higher interest rate bonds, in many cases, are trading above their maturity value, which is dangerous. Secondly, and this is the big scary thing, when Fitch looked at the if there was a run on those bond funds, a bunch of people decided to start liquidating and a bond fund said no. And by the way, bond funds in many cases have the ability to say no for 6 months. If they got out there and started liquidating at the rate we've seen these things happen in the past, there is not sufficient bond brokerage capacity in the system anymore to cover the sale of those bonds. And you would have bond funds saying, I'm sorry, you can't have your money, which could trigger a run on bond funds, which could be the next bubble, the thing that that takes us into the next recession.
Speaking of bonds and bubbles, you see that there was a restructuring of Puerto Rican bonds.
Oh, yeah, and some hedge funds made some big money.
Right. They backed the restructuring and provided the money to Puerto Rico to buy back some of the bonds from other investors, but they had to agree to take much lower than the face value. Well, now those hedge funds are making a decent profit because it took $6 billion off the value of the bonds that were out there. But it looks like a good percentage of that is going to go to the hedge funds. Not maximum percentage. It's going to be a smaller thing. But they're making a lot of money on this deal. It's kind of the thing where vultures people that do the digging for the graveyard, they have to get paid too. And these hedge funds are making a lot of money doing it.
And you hear news like that. And it is, you know, they bought some risky high yield bonds from Puerto Rico and came out on top on the deal. And you think, man, therein is the danger. High yield debt in general used to be called junk. And I've been around long enough to remember when Michael Milliken and the high yield bond market was the
junk
poster
bond.
Boy.
Yeah, the junk bond wizard,
which was called high yield, and then it was called junk, and then it was called garbage, and now it's back to simply being called high yield bonds, which is dangerous. How the entire high yield bond market collapsed rather abruptly, and he was the poster child for that. And it's been long enough ago now that when I talk to people about it, they don't remember it, which means that we're very likely to see it happen again.
Well, some of the people you're talking about weren't alive at the time.
It's true. What happens is we've had 30 years of generally falling interest rate. It probably bottomed in 2017, but we haven't seen the effect of rising interest rates, and we're probably going to have decades of rising interest rates. Rising interest rates cause a deterioration in bond values. If at that point, with the deterioration in bond values, whether it's in an annuity or a bond fund or wherever, there is a run on relatively shaky, relatively high-yield bonds. High-yield bonds, by definition, are the reason the companies are paying high interest rates is because they're poor credit quality. That could be the next trigger that turns what could be just a slowdown in the economy into a recession. That's very distinctly. The other thing, of course, and as far as a danger to trigger a recession, is a major trade war. But be aware that Fitch came out with a warning this week. If you have a high interest bearing bond fund and you're really proud of that high interest you're getting and you're really happy about it, don't feel too secure, because high interest equals high risk.
Yeah, and this is something people asked us why we on the air were talking about collateralized mortgage obligations in 2006. CMOs in 2006, they hadn't collapsed yet. Nobody
was
talking about them.
We're not saying good things about
them. No, we were talking bad things about them. And the reason is because anytime you look at interest rates, the market rate and then the interest rate that's being paid by a given product, whether that's a CMO or a high-yield bond, if you look at what interest you'll get from a relatively low-risk or zero-risk type position like the U.S. Treasury, you bought something from them and they're paying you 4%, say. I'm just throwing some numbers out there. And then there's a fund over here that's the high-yield fund, and they say it's high-quality, high-yield, and it's paying you 8%. Well, the problem with that is that the high-quality, it may be a relative term. High yield means high risk, and I'm going to give it to you in an example that everybody can understand. If you've ever had a credit card, or if you've ever bought a house, if you're going to buy a house and you have really good credit, you've been working hard on that credit for a while, and you go out and you start checking the prices and what the interest rates will be for you when you buy the house, when you get the mortgage, and a bank offers you an interest rate of 7%, and another bank, or you look at that and you say, that doesn't make any sense, I've got really good credit, that interest rates are nowhere near that high, you're going to say no to that. You're not going to pay 7% for your mortgage right now, because the going rate on mortgages is closer to 4.5%. If you go to another bank and they say 4.5%, which one are you going to choose? You're going to choose the lower rate. Businesses are exactly the same way. If they've got good credit, they haven't been defaulting on their debt or missing payments or overextending themselves, they don't have huge amounts of debt outstanding, then they're going to get a much lower interest rate, which means the businesses that are paying the higher interest rate on their debt, they're only paying that because they have to, because their credit is horrible. You shouldn't be proud about owning high interest rate debt. You should be, it is cunning. You can make a lot of money doing it, but you need to understand the risks involved. This is an important factor. If you don't understand the risks associated with that high return, you could very easily get shocked with a much lower return than it looks like you were promised. Because if those places that were paying the high interest rate, the reason why they're paying the high interest rate is because they've either defaulted or missed payments or they have too much debt, they're at the edge of being able to pay off their debt. And if you've got a credit card and you've got good credit and they're offering you a 0% rate and you say, this is great, and another credit card says, here, it's only 29.9%, which one are you going to choose? You're going to choose the best rate you can find. And corporations are better at that than individuals.
There, you know, we talk about these negatives, and there are some negatives, some big ones, one of which is Financial Advisor Magazine, which is mailed out to people who sell investments. Came out with a warning that index funds are potentially dangerous at this point, not because there's something wrong with them, but simply because they're proliferating, they're taking a bigger chunk, and Jack Bogle, before he died, said the same thing.
Yeah, he's the inventor of index funds.
And it's... So there's a lot of risk abounding in the economy. We can see a slowing economy coming. We can see that we're running out of room for the economy to grow forever. Trees don't grow to the sky. We're giving you all these warnings for the short term. And I say short term, meaning the next few years. Longer term, we have something really, really good to say, but I think we need to run commercials before we say it.
Yeah, let's do that.
See, that's a little long-term, that's a zinger out there.
Good news coming. Let's see if you'll stick around to listen to it.
It's good news for some people and kind of rough for others, but listen on the other side of commercials.
Yeah,
this has been the Personal Wealth Coach. Telephone number in here is 254-773-1400. And we're back with more of the Personal Wealth Coach with Jeff and
Jake
McClure. And a button that won't stay pressed.
Right. We have the on-air button, the microphone button, probably the most important button in the studio that when you press it, it turns on and then off.
There's a bigger picture out there. We're warning, you know, and somebody, I actually had one of our clients say, you, Jeff McClure, are saying good things about the future?
Because we... they obviously weren't listening to us in 2009, because that's all we were saying.
And we tend to be counter-cyclical. In other words, at the top, we say, whoa, there's a bottom coming. And at the bottom, we say, whoa, there's a top coming. And we tend to be ahead, and that's what people pay us for. But there's something we need to go beyond the probable, I think probable, 56%, according to Moody, probability of a recession in 2020. And say what's probably coming on the other side. I say probably very high probability what's coming on the other side, and that's important. And by the way, there's no timing this. People say, should I get out of the market?
Right, that's not the way to do it. You just make sure you've got good reserves and you've got the ability. Don't overextend. Don't overinvest. Just put the money in that you can afford. Make sure you have good reserves. And then don't pull it out because you think it's going to go down.
Trying to guess which way the market's going to go, by the way, the reason it looks like it's obvious we should be able to, but the problem is since nobody has been able to successfully do it on a consistent basis.
This is all also, I just said some things. I want to make sure diversification is part of that whole thing. It's an assumed, but it needs to be out there. If you're not diversified, then you probably should be doing some more research.
And if you don't know diversified doesn't mean five growth funds, by the way.
No. No, you need to see how much the overlap. If you've got five growth funds, you really probably only have one. They've got the same stuff in them.
So the issue is we think there is a recession coming. We think there is probably a bear market coming in 2020 or thereabouts. Maybe it won't happen. The reason we don't try to time it is very simple. Nobody that we've been able to find historically has been able to consistently get that right. They win a couple of times, and then they lose big. And it's like gambling. And the point is, the people who are long-term investors who are buy and hold in a well-diversified, balanced portfolio tend to do far better than the people who try to guess what's going to happen in the market.
There's another piece of news that came out this week on this subject. Bill Gross is retiring.
Yes.
Bill Gross is the bond king. He's been labeled that. He made a lot of really good bets on the bond market over the last decade.
More than a decade.
Yeah, more than a decade.
30 years.
But the big returns have been in the last decade. The big ones have been in the last decade. But in the last 4 years, he has repeatedly fallen flat on his face.
Mm-hmm.
He got kicked out of PIMCO, which is a big deal because he was one of the founders of PIMCO.
Right.
And he went on to some other places, and he hasn't done very well. And he finally just said, "All right, I'm done. The rules have changed, and I didn't get a memo." So he's on his way. I mean, he's had a storied career. He made money in an area that a lot of people did not. But this is exactly what you were saying. Even the professionals have a lot of trouble timing when the market's going to shift. You got to take the Warren Buffett approach. He is not a market timer. Absolutely the opposite.
Well, let's talk about what is likely to happen in our opinion. And that is that we're going to go through a recession, which we need one, by the way, to shake out the dead wood. But on the other side, more and more what we're seeing is automation doing more and more things. Matter of fact, it was an article this morning in the Wall Street Journal on it that was very, very good. It was kind of prescient because we put it in the newsletter last week or the end of last week.
Well, just that the journalists at the Wall Street Journal must
probably
be
reading
our newsletter. That's really what's
going
on.
But the point is, if you look at all the things that can be automated, and there are articles all over the place on what can succumb to what's sometimes called AI, but really isn't artificial intelligence. It's just automation. Everything to do with driving anything, or for that matter, flying much of anything, warehouse work, using a forklift, anything that's boring. The negative is something approaching 30% of the jobs in the United States are at risk. The positive is, remember earlier this program we said, gross domestic product is hours worked times output.
Minus trade deficit.
Minus a bunch of stuff, inflation and trade deficit, but basically the net output. If we can do more with fewer hours worked through automation, if we can dramatically accelerate the economy through automation, we can see a huge growth in the economy while there are fewer hours being worked. In other words, people being laid off. This is what happened in the 1920s as the internal combustion engine came online and trucks and tractors replaced people plowing behind mules and harvesting behind mules and hand harvesting. As engines, steam engines and internal combustion engines and electricity replaced workers in factories. Probability is we're going to see a huge surge in that. The Wall Street Journal article really was fascinating today in that it said in Lakeland, Florida, where they have this huge quantity of distribution warehouses, the owners and managers are saying, we have the ability to basically replace all of our workers. It's just not currently cost effective to do so. But the price of automation comes down each year, and the price of workers goes up each year. And at some point, they're going to cross, and that'll probably be in the next recession. When that occurs, to cut costs, corporations will probably do massive investing in automation, and that will start a stampede in that direction. So if you're in a skilled position, if you're have a big investment portfolio, if you're in a position where you're not relying on manual labor work to make ends meet, the 2020s very well may be the best decade you've ever seen in your life. It may be the biggest growth in GDP we've seen in the history of the United States. If you are a poorly skilled worker and you don't have education and you don't have the ability to use your mind to do things, it's going to be rough. It's going to be like the 1920s were for agricultural workers. And if a lot of people don't remember that, read The Grapes of Wrath sometime. Grapes of Wrath wasn't something that happened in the 1930s. It was something that happened in the 1920s. Agricultural workers were displaced. And they tried to go to California and find work picking vegetables. And so we've probably, in my opinion, going to repeat that, but it's going to be an economic boom time. And we have a caller on 773-1400. You're on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead.
In regards to what you're saying right now, what do you expect is going to happen with all these illegal immigrants that are coming in that are not going to be able to withstand that technological move when they can't feed their families and they don't have any way to get any income?
I have a pretty good answer to that right away. The pretty good answer to that is the numbers on illegal immigrants peaked out in 2006 and 2007. And then we had the Great Recession, and we stopped buying lots of houses. And that was one of the major employers for illegal immigrants. It still is, but it's much lower on the major employment spectrum, a lot fewer employed there. What happened is that everyone that didn't, or not everyone, this is a bit of a hyperbole, a lot of the illegal immigrants that did not have deep roots here, didn't have a family here, didn't have kids in school, the single men that were sending the money back to Mexico, back to Guatemala, left. They went back to Mexico or to Guatemala or to El Salvador. And we saw during the Great Recession, this is one of those things that we've talked about on the air quite a few times, we saw a great exodus of illegal immigrants during the Great Recession. They have turned around and started coming back in a trickle, but it's not the same people. Because the people that left from the construction world, they were in their late 40s. In 2007, which puts them in their late 50s or early 60s now. They are not working construction anymore. They stayed in Mexico. We've got a wave coming in from Guatemala and from El Salvador and from China. Those are China's the number one immigration. Guatemala is right up there on the top of the number one illegal immigration. And they're not leaving Guatemala to come here and get good jobs like the Mexican immigrants were before. They're leaving Guatemala to stop from being killed by gang members and so on.
And the government.
So what? It's a very different situation. It's a good question, and we don't know. What we have to do is have some compassion in that approach to say we can't just knock them back to be murdered. They didn't come here to steal jobs. They came here to not be murdered. There's a different level of illegal immigration, and that's something that's missing in the current debate. The current debate is this: either completely stop it or have 100% compassion, and neither of those work. We have to have some immigration, and we have to have compassion in the process, but we cannot have uncontrolled illegal immigration. So if automation comes and replaces them, it's likely that they will leave.
If you're talking about in terms of illegal immigrants, a big chunk of them, the Dreamers, for example, they are well-educated people, generally speaking.
Right.
Many of them have completed college. Many of them have gone through military service. You know, the issue is they probably won't leave unless somebody arrests them and make them leave, and I don't think that's going to go over too well.
Right. They speak English as a first language.
And so it's a very complex question you're answering, whether you know it or not.
I'm talking about the people who are actually on their way right now.
Well, they're still going to try to flee being killed.
Yeah, that's not going to stop with walls or with lack of jobs. That's not why they're coming.
You know, if somebody was going to kill your wife and children, and your choice is to either stay here and get killed or go to England without a visa to go to England, you'd probably find some way to get to England.
Even if the people in England are saying, don't come.
Yeah.
But the people in America, some of us are saying, don't come. And even the people that are saying, don't come, are still offering to pay you if you show up.
Yeah. And
but, guys, we have an influx of crime here.
That's not true.
Not true. Check the statistics on this. The FBI statistics are pretty clear on this. We are down on crime and have been down on crime for a decade.
An immigrant, legal or illegal, even illegal immigrants, have a much, much lower crime rate than U.S. citizens.
And that's not palatable. It's not. There's a different kind of un-PC now. We're not saying, and people hear us say stuff like that and think we're somehow supporting illegal immigrants, illegal immigration. We're not. We are not saying illegal immigration is a good thing. It needs to be controlled. It needs to be regulated. It needs to be tracked. We need to be able to collect taxes if people are working here. We need to make sure that we're not taking people in that are literally stealing jobs. But at the same time, if we treat all illegal immigration the same, it's like treating all of anything the same. It's not the same. We have to look at this with some degree of flexibility. If somebody's coming because they're in fear for their lives, us saying don't come isn't going to stop them. Us putting a wall up isn't going to stop them. We've got to do some other method. Maybe the wall will be part of that, but we've got to have some other methods.
We're out of time.
We're out of time. Thank you very much for the call.
This has been the Personal Wealth Coach. If you'd like to contact us off the air during the week, it's 254-947-1111 or
1-800-914-7526. You can go to our webpage, thepersonalwealthcoach.com or tpwc.com. Until next week, this has been...